We would like to send out a special thanks to the fun and challenging Best Fiends, the infamously impossible-to-put-down puzzle game. Download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thank you, and enjoy the show.
April 10th, 1967. Hometown, Illinois. Ralph Probst, a 30-year-old officer with the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department, spends the night at home watching television with his wife before he heads into the kitchen. Moments later, Ralph is fatally shot in the back of the head after an unknown assailant fires a bullet through the kitchen window. Investigators look into the possibility that Ralph's murder may have been orchestrated by a notorious mobster, or that he was killed because he was secretly working on a big case involving a vice ring, but no one is ever charged with the crime. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring two cold cases involving the deaths of police officers: the 1967 murder of Ralph Probst, and the unexplained 1988 death of Michael O'Mara. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Claire Simpson, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Claire. This is a popular recurring monthly contest which we've been holding for over 3 years now, and if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions at the end of this episode. Anyway, there are some major similarities between these two stories. They were both featured on episodes of Unsolved Mysteries, and involved victims who worked for the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department in Illinois. But there are some key differences involving the circumstances of how each of these men died. Ralph Probst was only a couple of years into his police career before he was shot through the back of his head while standing inside the kitchen of his home. By comparison, Michael O'Mara was in the twilight of his police career and was preparing for a quiet retirement before he was found with a gunshot wound to the head while getting gas. But while there was zero doubt that Ralph's death was a murder, Mike's death was initially ruled to be a suicide because his own gun was found next to his body and there was virtually no evidence pointing to the presence of an outside party. However, there were enough suspicious discrepancies to make Mike's family believe that he was the victim of foul play. One thing these cases do have in common is that both Ralph and Mike had reputations for being honest police officers who always played by the rules, so they easily could have made enemies who wanted them dead. So we'll start off this episode by exploring Ralph's murder before I present my theories and analysis, and then I'll move on to Mike's case. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by examining the unsolved murder of Ralph Probst. Our story begins in Illinois in 1967, and our central figure is 30-year-old Ralph Probst. During his early 20s, Ralph had worked as a chemical engineer, but he decided to pursue a career in law enforcement. Shortly after graduating from the police academy, Ralph joined the Cook County Sheriff's Office, which was divided up into a number of different departments, and he ultimately became an officer for the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department. By this point, Ralph is nearing his 3-year anniversary in law enforcement, and he currently lives with his wife Marlene Probst, as well as their son and 2 daughters, in a suburban duplex in hometown, which has a population of around 7,000 people and borders Chicago. On April the 10th, Ralph and Marlene sat down for what they believed would be a relaxing evening to watch the 39th Annual Academy Awards on television. According to Marlene, she fell asleep on the couch in the middle of the broadcast until she was suddenly awakened shortly after 10 p.m. by what sounded like a loud explosion. Marlene then noticed that Ralph was no longer in the living room, and a cloud of smoke had appeared behind the television set and was emanating from the kitchen. When Marlene walked in there, she was shocked to discover Ralph lying on the floor with a gunshot wound to the back of his head. Marlene immediately called for help, and Ralph would be rushed to the nearest hospital by paramedics, but he never regained consciousness and died approximately 20 minutes after he was shot. Police noticed a hole in the kitchen window, and it seemed like the killer had fired the fatal shot through the glass from outside. A search of the kitchen would turn up a .41 caliber bullet, which had ricocheted off a cabinet after passing through Ralph's head and landed on the stove. Investigators questioned Ralph's neighbors, but while a few of them did recall hearing what sounded like a gunshot, none of them saw anyone standing outside the kitchen window or fleeing the scene. The weapon the bullet originated from was a .41 caliber Magnum handgun, which had only been manufactured a short time before the murder. In fact, the gun was so rare that only 2,000 of them existed in the United States at that point, but investigators never had any luck tracking it down. Ralph's partner at the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department was Bob Borowski, who worked with him in an elite unit called the Tactical Squad, which investigated cases involving organized crime. Borowski also considered Ralph to be one of his closest friends, and made a vow to never give up at catching his killer. Well, believe it or not, Ralph's wife Marlene was actually looked at as a potential suspect. The one part of her story which troubled investigators was her claim that she had seen smoke emanating from the kitchen behind the TV set, even though Ralph had seemingly been shot by someone standing outside the house. They also found it odd that the broken glass from the window was found in the yard rather than on the kitchen floor, which seemed to lean towards Ralph being shot from indoors. For this reason, the police decided to perform a test in which they stood outside and fired some shots through the kitchen window. When they fired a shot from 15 feet away, the glass wound up on the kitchen floor and no smoke could be seen from the living room. However, when they moved closer and fired a shot through the window from only 2 inches away, the glass wound up landing in the yard and a visible cloud of smoke appeared inside the kitchen. This meant that Marlene's story checked out and confirmed that the killer had fired at Ralph from very close range. The logistics of the shooting seemed to indicate that the perpetrator must have been at least 5'11" or higher and had very good accuracy, giving off the impression that Ralph's murder was a professional hit. But the one baffling unanswered question was how the killer even knew Ralph would be inside the kitchen at that particular time. All of the house's other windows were covered that night, and in order to see through the kitchen window, the shooter would have had to stand near the driveway, which was very well lit. If they stood there for an extended period of time, waiting for Ralph to enter the kitchen, they ran a huge risk of being seen. Well, it turned out that on the afternoon of Ralph's death, he was seen visiting a gas station and making a call from a payphone. This led to speculation that Ralph had spoken to someone about making or receiving a phone call at a specific time later that night, and since his house phone was located inside the kitchen, the killer knew exactly when Ralph would be there. All of the arrests Ralph made during his police career were reviewed to search for any potential suspects who might have had a motive to kill him. The reason that Ralph and Bob Borowski had been assigned to the department's tactical squad was because they had reputations for being honest, trustworthy officers who always did things by the book. For this reason, one of the first people Borowski looked at was Sam DiStefano, who was known for being a ruthless loan shark and killer in the notorious organized crime syndicate, the Chicago Outfit. In January of 1967, less than 3 months before Ralph's murder, DiStefano was in the midst of serving a 3 to 5 year prison sentence for conspiracy when he was transferred to the Cook County Jail Hospital after complaining of stomach pains. Ralph and Bob were given the assignment of guarding him, but when they arrived at DiStefano's hospital room, they discovered that he was being visited by family members who had brought him a fancy Chinese dinner and fruit baskets. Ralph immediately informed them that no visitors were allowed, and DiStefano was only authorized to eat the hospital's food. But DiStefano's family were ordered to leave the room. He wound up becoming angry, so Ralph decided to handcuff him to his bed, prompting DiStefano to cry out, "You'll be sorry you treated me this way." Borowski didn't think much of this at the time, but after Ralph was killed, he decided to explore the possibility that DiStefano orchestrated the whole thing. Well, no evidence was ever found to implicate DiStefano, and he would be murdered himself after receiving 2 shotgun blasts inside his garage in April of 1973. 2 weeks before his death, Ralph took a leave of absence from the tactical squad and began taking training classes with the department's canine unit, which would give him more free time to spend nights at home with his family. In spite of this, Borowski believed that Ralph was doing his own secret investigative work, as he made reference to working on a quote-unquote big case, and once stated, quote, "I'm working on something, and when I solve it, they're going to make me a sergeant," end quote. In fact, Ralph seemed so certain that he would soon be receiving a promotion that he decided to order himself a new car. But even though Ralph ordinarily kept his police files inside his car, they could not be found following the murder. Borowski set his eyes on an ex-convict named Frank Calvez, who was known for being a cartage thief and suspected of being involved in a vice ring during this time period. Ralph was seen visiting Calvez's home in the days prior to his death, where he briefly spoke with Calvez's wife before leaving. It also turned out that the owner of a house located across the street from Ralph's residence had put his home up for sale, and he told police that a potential male buyer stopped by there about a week before Ralph was killed. The homeowner proceeded to give this man a tour, and at one point, he proceeded to point out the window at the Probst residence across the street. The man asked if the house had a similar floor plan, to which the homeowner replied that it did. The description he provided of this man seemed to match Frank Calvez, giving off the impression that Calvez may have been scouting the Probst residence in order to plan out a professional hit on Ralph. The homeowner would later identify Calvez in a police lineup, but then abruptly changed his story, stating that if the responsible party was willing to shoot Ralph Probst, they would not hesitate to shoot him as well. As a result, no charges were ever filed in connection to Ralph's murder, and Calvez passed away in 1974. Even though he was not officially assigned to the case, Bob Borowski would spend the next 2 decades working on it unofficially in his spare time. In 1987, on the 20th anniversary of Ralph's murder, Borowski paid his own money to run ads about the case in the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Sun-Times, providing a post office box number if anyone with information wanted to come forward. While Borowski received a number of cards and letters, they failed to bring the case any closer to a resolution, though it did garner the attention of Unsolved Mysteries, who featured the story on one of their episodes, which aired in April of 1990. But in the end, no one was ever brought to justice for the crime, and there's still no answers about who was actually responsible for shooting Ralph Probst. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Best Fiends. We all have our forms of entertainment which are guilty pleasures. If you know me well, you're probably aware that in addition to true crime, I have a devout interest in a number of unique areas which could be considered guilty pleasures, such as cheesy B-movies and professional wrestling. But you know what I feel exactly zero guilt about? How much I love playing Best Fiends. Because Best Fiends gives me an endless source of fun that I can access anytime right on my phone. Best Fiends is a match-3 puzzle game like none other, with literally thousands of levels and new content added all the time. I've been playing for over a year now, and I'm a little obsessed. Okay, a lot obsessed. I've stated on numerous occasions that covering an unsolved cold case on this podcast is sometimes like putting together a massive jigsaw puzzle, but while Best Fiends also offers its fair share of challenging puzzles, they're presented in a way that allow me to de-stress between recording sessions. I'm slowly easing my way towards level 950 on the game, and I cannot wait until I reach the magic milestone of level 1000 sometime in the near future. It's a pretty fun experience, and if it sounds like fun to you as well, you can download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play and get started. And be sure to let me know what you think. Best Fiends is the infamously impossible to put down puzzle game that's free to download, and with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. More levels, events, and challenges get added all the time. So play away, there's always one more level. Seriously, once you download Best Fiends, boredom won't stand a chance. Download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the episode. So at the beginning of the Unsolved Mystery segment, Robert Stack makes this statement, quote, "It is said that there is no such thing as the perfect crime, but for more than two decades, the murder of Ralph Probst has come uncomfortably close," end quote. While those words certainly ring true, because if someone murders a police officer in cold blood, they generally have to be pretty lucky in order to get away with it, because law enforcement is usually going to go all out trying to bring them to justice. This would especially apply to Ralph Probst, as not only did he seem to be a very well-respected cop with an honest reputation, but he was also a loving husband and father who was shot to death inside his own home while his wife was in the next room. He was also shot with an incredibly rare brand of gun, of which there were only 2,000 in existence in the US at that time, yet this still wasn't enough to catch the perpetrator. When the murder of a police officer goes unsolved, and the investigation reaches a complete standstill, one can't help but wonder if it was an inside job, or if corrupt forces were at play to prevent the perpetrator from getting caught. Over the years, there has definitely been a lot of corruption in Cook County involving organized crime and the police, though there haven't been any real serious allegations about a cover-up in this particular case. We know that Ralph's partner, Bob Borowski, worked diligently for the next two decades to solve the crime, but at no point did he ever flat-out say that there were people in power who did not want the killer to be caught. It was a pretty bold move for Borowski to take out ads in the major Chicago newspapers asking people to come forward if they had information, but it's worth noting that he did this in 1987, when the responsible parties may have already been deceased or in prison for other crimes. The Unsolved Mysteries segment does mention that Ralph's wife Marlene was looked at as a potential suspect at the outset, but I think that was only because her detail about smoke emanating from the kitchen did not seem to match the physics of the crime. But once they performed some tests, and determined that it was possible for smoke to appear like that if the shot was fired right next to the window, the suspicion about Marlene completely dissipated. Marlene even appeared on Unsolved Mysteries to talk about the case, and as a widow who was left with three children to raise on her own, she really had nothing to gain at all from Ralph's death, so there's zero reason to believe she was involved. But on the other hand, I can see why people might have been inclined to doubt her story, since the circumstances of how Ralph was killed were so unusual. If this was a professional hit from an outsider, how could the killer have known that Ralph would appear in the kitchen in front of the window at that particular moment? I mean, it's reasonable to assume that he would have set foot inside there at some point during the evening, but it makes no practical sense for the shooter to wait outside next to a well-lit driveway in a suburban neighborhood for what could have been hours, which runs a huge risk of them being seen. It's interesting how some of the articles about this case specifically mention Ralph going into the kitchen to get a glass of water, but how could the killer have predicted this would happen? That's why I'm intrigued by the theory that this was an ambush, and Ralph was planning to use the phone at that particular time. I doubt that Ralph walked into the kitchen to answer the phone, as Marlene had fallen asleep, and likely would have been woken up if she heard the phone ringing. But since Ralph was seen making a phone call from a gas station payphone earlier that day, which has never been fully explained, it's possible that the whole thing was a setup. The person Ralph spoke to either instructed him to make a call or wait by his phone to receive a call at a specific time later that evening, and that's how the shooter knew he would be there. Now, the Unsolved Mystery segment pushes forward two criminals as potential suspects, Sam DiStefano and Frank Calvese, but while DiStefano is such a notorious figure that there is no shortage of material on him, there really isn't much information out there at all about Calvese. But before I talk more about them, I have to discuss another infamous organized crime figure who has been linked to this case. Last March, our podcast released an episode about the Indiana Dunes women, which involved the unsolved disappearances of 21-year-old Ann Miller, 19-year-old Patricia Blau, and 19-year-old Renee Brule, who all went missing. The three women originally hailed from Illinois, but vanished during a trip to the Indiana Dunes State Park in July of 1966, and during the episode, I discussed the possibility that an organized crime figure named Silas Jane might have been responsible for what happened. Jane ran a gang of criminals known as the Horse Syndicate, who earned that nickname because they often used the buying, selling, and betting of racehorses as a front for their criminal activities. The amount of crimes that Jane and the Horse Syndicate are responsible or believed to be responsible for are too numerous to discuss here, but one of the most infamous is the murder of 22-year-old Sherry Rude, who was killed in a car bombing in July of 1965. Silas had a heated rivalry with his half-brother, George Jane, who owned the vehicle which blew up, and had asked Rude to move it for him before the bomb went off. It seemed very likely that the bomb was intended for George, and Silas orchestrated the whole thing. In October of 1970, George wound up being shot to death, and Silas and four of his crew members were eventually charged for their roles in his murder. Silas only had to serve 6 years in prison before he died of leukemia in 1987, but within a few years, there would be a renewed interest in solving cold cases which were believed to be connected to Silas and the Horse Syndicate. Sure enough, one of Silas's former associates, James Blaudio, was eventually charged and convicted of planting the car bomb which killed Sherry Rude. Another infamous Chicago cold case which wound up being solved during this time period was the triple murder of three boys, 14-year-old Robert Peterson, 13-year-old John Schuessler, and his 11-year-old brother, Anton Schuessler Jr., whose nude bodies had been found in a ditch in 1955. A suspect named Kenneth Hansen was charged and convicted of the crime, and it turned out he was a former associate of Silas Jane, who had operated some of his horse stables. Hansen killed the boys inside a barn on Silas's property, so Silas made sure the bodies were moved to another location so that he wouldn't be implicated in the crime. Anyway, in August of 1994, the Associated Press ran an article which listed all the unsolved cold cases being investigated by the authorities which were believed to have a connection to the Horse Syndicate. They included the cases I just discussed, among others, but they also briefly mentioned the murder of Ralph Probst. Indeed, there was speculation that the quote-unquote big case Ralph said he was working on prior to his death may have been a case that was related to the Horse Syndicate, such as the murders of the three boys or the car bombing which killed Sherry Rude. In fact, the former Cook County police chief said there was evidence that Ralph had visited one of the horse stables which belonged to Kenneth Hansen, though he added, quote, it was part of his jurisdiction and a matter of routine. It's also worth mentioning that Ralph's death bore some similarities to the 1970 murder of George Jane, as one of Silas's associates shot George through his basement window while he was playing bridge with his family. But while it does seem likely that Ralph was the victim of a professional hit connected to an investigation he was working on, no conclusive evidence has ever been found to suggest that Silas Jane or the Horse Syndicate were behind it. So let's go back to discussing the two potential suspects mentioned in Unsolved Mysteries. The main reason the authorities looked at Sam DiStefano was because of the incident which took place less than 3 months before Ralph's murder, where Ralph was assigned to guard DiStefano's hospital room, but refused to allow him any special privileges and handcuffed DiStefano to his bed. Even though this made DiStefano angry, and he made a veiled threat, under normal circumstances, I wouldn't expect a mobster to order the assassination of a police officer over such a minor incident. But the word normal does not belong in the same sentence as Sam DiStefano, and there's a reason here in the nickname, Mad Sam. Quite simply, DiStefano was the personification of a gangster who enjoyed sadistically torturing and killing people. He was the Chicago outfit's leading loan shark, and had a reputation for lending out money to people he knew were unreliable, because he looked forward to taking them to the soundproof torture chamber he had built inside his basement when they could not pay him back. While the outfit obviously found DiStefano's violent streak to be useful, he was also too mentally unstable for them to ever consider turning him into a made guy. In April of 1973, DiStefano was awaiting trial for a murder he was involved in before he was shot to death inside his garage, and while no one was ever charged with the crime, it was suspected that DiStefano's own brother set him up to be killed by mobster Anthony Spilotro, aka Tony the Ant. And if you've ever seen the 1995 Martin Scorsese-directed film Casino, you'll probably remember Joe Pesci's portrayal of the ultra-violent, hot-headed gangster Nicky Santoro, a character who was directly based on Tony the Ant. So that should give you a pretty good idea of the psychopaths who were involved in the Chicago outfit during this time period. The point being, Sam DiStefano was such a violent and unstable individual that it's not completely implausible that he could have held a major grudge against Ralph over the hospital incident. I believe DiStefano was still incarcerated at the time the murder took place, so he obviously would have needed someone else to perform the hit for him. The most likely candidate to be the trigger man is Frank Calvez, but I don't see any indication that he had a connection to DiStefano. Overall, I am inclined to believe that DiStefano had no involvement in the crime, and Ralph was assassinated because of something else he was working on. Ralph was technically on a leave of absence from the tactical squad at this time, since he was taking classes with the department's canine unit, but it's heavily implied that Ralph was secretly doing his own independent work on another case on the side. We have a sighting of Ralph visiting Calvez's wife and speaking to her shortly before his death, and there doesn't seem to be any reason for Ralph to be associating with an ex-con like him unless he was working on something. The strongest evidence against Calvez was the homeowner from across the street, who claimed that he gave a tour to a man matching Calvez's description, who asked a number of questions about the Probst residence. But any chance of building a case against Calvez was ruined when the homeowner recanted his story, and you get the impression that someone may have scared him out of talking. Like I mentioned earlier, there's very little information out there about Calvez, as all I could find were a few articles in the Chicago Tribune from February of 1963, which mentioned Calvez's name as one of seven men who were arrested in an FBI sting operation involving the recovery of $100,000 in stolen merchandise from some hijackings. He obviously didn't do much, if any, prison time in relation to these charges, since he was a free man again by April of 1967, but I've never found any indication that he was a professional killer, and it certainly seems like the person who shot Ralph was pretty skilled about what they were doing. I know Calvez died 7 years later, but if he was the trigger man, I seriously doubt he was working alone. During the Unsolved Mysteries segment, one of the investigators makes this interesting statement about the shooter. Quote, "He could have been a professional hitman, and he could always have been a law enforcement person." End quote. No direct accusations were ever made during the segment about someone from law enforcement being involved in the crime, but it's worth mentioning that the first policeman to arrive at the scene would be complicit in another murder nearly 15 years later. The name of the policeman in question was James Keating, who happened to be one of Ralph's classmates at the academy. As the years went on, Keating would be promoted to Cook County Sheriff's Lieutenant and commanded the Vice Squad and Criminal Intelligence Unit. But Keating also happened to be one of the most corrupt police officers in the area, who was known for accepting bribes from organized crime figures to protect gambling and prostitution rings. In 1985, Keating was one of five Cook County law enforcement officers who were indicted in a federal undercover investigation into vice corruption called Operation Safe Bet, and after being convicted on charges of racketeering, extortion, conspiracy, and income tax fraud, he received a 15-year prison sentence. Well, within 2 years of his conviction, Keating would be implicated in the murder of a woman named Diane Masters, who went missing in March of 1982, before her body was found 9 months later. It turned out that the murder was orchestrated by your estranged husband, Alan Masters, who was friends with Keating and paid him to organize his wife's murder and obstruct the investigation. While no one was actually charged with the actual killing, Masters, Keating, and a former Willow Springs police chief named Michael Corbett were all convicted on the charges of conspiracy and racketeering and received lengthy prison sentences. Now, no evidence has ever been found to prove that Keating was involved in Ralph Probst's murder, and being only a couple years out of the academy, he was much lower on the food chain of the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department in 1967. But it's been reported that Ralph's police files vanished from his car following his death, and a notebook which Ralph always carried around with him also supposedly went missing without explanation, even though it can apparently be seen in photographs which were taken of the murder scene. And who would have been in a better position of ensuring that evidence disappeared than a police officer? I also think it's worth noting that Keating was already in prison by the time Bob Borowski placed the ads about Ralph's case in the newspapers in 1987, so if Keating was involved, I'm sure Borowski knew he was no longer in any position to obstruct the investigation, and people might have been more willing to talk. Regardless, even if Keating had nothing to do with it, there was never any shortage of corruption in Cook County law enforcement, so I have no trouble believing that someone else on the inside might have been complicit. Given all the time that has passed, it seems likely that most of, if not all, the individuals who know the full truth about what happened are now deceased, but this definitely comes across as a clear-cut example of an honest, hard-working cop being murdered because he got too close to something. It would be nice to receive full answers after all these years, so if by chance you happen to have any information about the unsolved murder of Ralph Probst, please contact the appropriate authorities. So now let's move on to our second story. Our second story begins in Illinois in 1988, and our central figure is 48-year-old Michael O'Mara, who goes by the name Mike. Mike lives just outside of Chicago in the village of Flossmoor with his wife Barbara, whom he's been married to for 26 years, along with her son and daughter. At this point, Mike is a captain with the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department and winding down what has been a distinguished 27-year career in law enforcement. At the beginning of his career, Mike made history by becoming the first Cook County officer to graduate from the FBI Academy and had such an honest reputation that he was eventually asked to assemble a vice unit of incorruptible police officers to take on the mafia. O'Mara would spend 7 years orchestrating a number of busts and arrests in the Chicago suburb of Cicero, closing down mob-run operations which involved gambling and prostitution. According to the O'Mara family's attorney, Michael McArdle, quote, "The Cook County Police Department was really looked down as do-nothings in law enforcement circles, and Mike excelled far above most other people in that department, and he was respected by federal agency officers. Not just because of his highly visible work for the Cook County Sheriff's Department, but because of his captivating personal character traits." End quote. For his efforts, Mike received the Meritorious Service Award, the highest police administrative honor, as well as 2 department letters of commendation, and he would be promoted to the rank of captain in 1978. But over the course of the next decade, O'Mara was assigned to the quiet desk job as commander of the Cook County Sheriff's Records and Communications Division. He seemed to be contemplating retirement once he reached the 30-year minimum for service, and was thinking about moving his family to Florida in order to teach courses in law enforcement. During this time period, Mike also started up his own side security business called Private Security Institute, but he was thinking of dissolving it once he retired. On the evening of May 30th, which happened to be Memorial Day, Mike had dinner at home with his family, but at around 8 p.m., he told them he needed to step out to run some errands. He said he would pick up some frozen yogurt for everyone and asked which flavors they wanted, but he soon realized that he did not have any cash in his wallet. Mike asked Barbara if he could borrow some money, so she told Mike to help himself to some cash she had inside her purse. Mike then left the house and drove away in his unmarked police car, but this turned out to be the last time his family ever saw him alive. By the time 11:30 rolled around, Mike had still not returned home, but Barbara received a shock when two representatives from the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department showed up at the residence. They informed her that Mike had been found dead near the Cook County Circuit 6 Municipal District Courthouse in the Chicago suburb of Markham. Shortly after leaving his home, Mike had stopped by the corporate office for Private Security Institute in order to drop off some work. The last communication from Mike occurred at 8:30 when he radioed dispatchers from his car to inform them he was on duty. Approximately 45 minutes later, a Cook County patrolman drove into a private service area located just outside the aforementioned courthouse in Markham. The area had a gas pump, which police officers and county employees could use to get fuel using a pass card, but the patrolman was surprised to find Mike's empty car parked at the pump with the nozzle in the tank. Even though the keys were still in the ignition and the trunk was open, Mike himself was nowhere to be found. The patrolman decided to search a landscaped grassy area surrounding the gas pump, and he soon came across Mike's body, which was slumped over a large granite boulder located about 50 feet away from his vehicle. The patrolman initially thought that Mike may have suffered a heart attack and radioed for paramedics, but when they arrived at the scene and turned Mike's body over, they discovered a bullet hole in his forehead. Mike's flashlight and his .38 caliber Colt Cobra service revolver, which he had presumably removed from a briefcase in his trunk, were lying on the ground next to his body. It seemed apparent that the fatal shot came from Mike's own gun, as there was a spent casing under the hammer and 5 live rounds left in the chambers. Mike still had his wallet on him, and his car appeared to be untouched, so it did not appear that he was the victim of a robbery, and there was no sign of any struggle at the scene. While there were other nearby witnesses who recalled hearing a gunshot, and one of them even reported seeing a dark car pulling into the service area, there was no evidence which pointed towards anyone besides Mike ever being present at the scene. 2 weeks later, the Cook County Medical Examiner, Dr. Robert Stein, officially ruled that Mike's death was a suicide. While the O'Mara family disagreed with this ruling, insisting that Mike had no personal problems or showed any signs of being depressed enough to take his own life. Even though Mike's private security business was not very successful, Barbara said that it was not saddling the family with debts or causing any serious financial issues. Mike was also a devout Roman Catholic, and his brother, Bill O'Mara, happened to be a Catholic priest, so everyone who knew him did not believe he ever would have considered the option of suicide. Barbara claimed that Mike appeared to be in good spirits when he left their home, and from a practical standpoint, she could not understand why he would ask to borrow money from her to buy frozen yogurt if he was planning to take his own life. Barbara also found it suspicious that when the police showed up at her door to inform her about Mike's death later that night, one of them apparently told her it was suicide, even though it was way too early in the investigation to make that determination. There were also questions about how well the crime scene was handled, as Mike's vehicle was never checked for fingerprints, and the bullet which passed through his head was never actually recovered. The day after Mike's death, construction crews performed some resurfacing work on the parking area surrounding the gas pumps, but the police never bothered asking them to delay it so they could continue searching for the missing bullet. As a result, it could not be conclusively established that the fatal shot to Mike's head actually originated from his own gun. One odd clue from the scene was a piece of paper found several feet away from Mike's body, which had what appeared to be an address scribbled on it, as well as some fingerprints which could not be matched to anyone. It turned out the address belonged to a residence in South Holland, where a bailiff from the nearby courthouse lived, but she claimed to have no idea who Michael O'Mara was or why that piece of paper was found at the scene. Most disturbingly, the crime scene photo seemed to show some visible lacerations on Mike's face, which were never explained, and he also had a hematoma on his skull, which could have been caused by a violent blow. As far as potential suspects, there was a former sheriff's officer who had been working under O'Mara and was suspended for alcohol-related problems about a month before Mike's death. This guy reportedly said he would get revenge, but department records show no indication that he was ever interviewed, and he would die of natural causes 6 months later. In spite of these discrepancies, the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department were so certain that O'Meara's death was a suicide that they gave orders that an honor guard not be provided at his funeral, even though this was standard practice for fallen officers. Due to the suicide ruling, Barbara was prevented from collecting her husband's pension and insurance benefits, which had a double indemnity clause if he was killed in the line of duty. When Barbara filed a lawsuit and took the matter to court, she claimed she was subjected to prank phone calls and harassment, including incidents where her son's car was broken into and the family dog was poisoned. To further her case, Barbara hired the services of noted forensic pathologist Dr. Vincent DeMaio, who was the chief medical examiner of Bexar County, Texas at that time, and known for being one of the country's biggest experts on gunshot wounds. After reviewing the coroner's findings, Dr. DeMaio expressed his belief that Mike's death was not a suicide. During a deposition, DeMaio testified that the vast majority of self-inflicted gunshot wounds he had seen were contact wounds, where the victim would put the gun firmly against their skin when they discharged it. But in O'Meara's case, there was powder tattooing on the skin around the entrance wound, which seemed to indicate that the muzzle of the gun would have been approximately 4 inches away at the time it was fired. DeMaio also had issues with the downward trajectory of the bullet, as Mike would have had to hold the gun slightly above his forehead with his arms fully extended out in front of him and bent backwards with both thumbs on the trigger. This was an uncomfortable position, which could throw off the projectile when the trigger was pulled and cause the trajectory of the shot to miss its target. As an experienced marksman, Mike would have known that holding the gun in this position caused a risk of a suicide attempt being unsuccessful. While there were small amounts of nitrate detected on the palms of both of Mike's hands, it was not enough to scientifically prove that he had fired a gun, and the fingerprints on his service revolver were of such poor quality that it was impossible to determine who they belonged to. Theoretically, if someone forced Mike to hold up his hands in the air at gunpoint, the gunshot residue could have found its way onto Mike's palms after the shot was fired. DeMaio theorized that after pulling into the service area to get gas and putting the pump's nozzle into his fuel tank, Mike heard or saw something which compelled him to grab his gun and flashlight before walking out onto the lawn. But he soon crossed paths with someone who managed to get a hold of Mike's gun and used it to shoot him in the forehead before they left the gun next to his body. The insurance company finally told Barbara that they found Dr. DeMaio's analysis to be convincing enough that they were willing to make an out-of-court settlement, and she would receive $142,500. The Cook County Medical Examiner, Dr. Robert Stein, had also been asked to give a deposition, and he testified to having initially listed his finding on Mike's death certificate as, quote-unquote, pending further investigation. However, when the police started pressuring him to speed up the investigation, he changed the official ruling to suicide. Following the settlement, a judge recommended that the word suicide be removed from the death certificate, and Dr. Stein agreed to do so. Years later, an independent arbitrator with the Industrial Commission of Illinois was also convinced by Dr. DeMaio's analysis and awarded Barbara compensation of death benefits she had been denied by Cook County when her husband's death was ruled a suicide. The case would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in January of 1995, but the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department still remained unconvinced that Mike was the victim of foul play. They even pushed forward the theory that he made an intentional decision to make his suicide look like a homicide and ensure that his family would be taken care of financially. For this reason, a new investigation was never officially opened, and the actual circumstances surrounding Michael O'Meara's death remain up for debate. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So I think it's safe to say that this story is an even bigger puzzler than the Ralph Probst case, as there's a lot more ambiguity about whether the victim was actually murdered or if they decided to take their own life. You can draw a lot of parallels between the lives of Ralph Probst and Michael O'Meara, as they both joined the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department during the 1960s and were assigned to work in special tactical units because of their reputations for being honest and by the book. In fact, when you read about Mike's exploits taking down the Mafia, you get the impression that this is the same type of career Ralph would have enjoyed if he had not been murdered. Given that Mike spent years fighting organized crime and established himself as a cop who could not be bought, you can see how he might have made some enemies who wanted him dead, but the issue is that he was killed during the twilight of his career when he was nearing retirement and working a quiet job behind a desk in the records division. While it seemed likely that Ralph Probst was working on an important case at the time he was shot, I get the impression that it had been years since O'Mara took on any dangerous assignments, so why would someone have felt compelled to shoot him in the head in a public place? Did someone really hold a long-standing grudge against him for something that happened many years earlier? When I first watched the Unsolved Mysteries segment about O'Mara's case many years ago, I never really believed the possibility that his death could have been a suicide. Mike's loved ones kept saying that he was not unhappy or depressed, and borrowing money from your wife to buy frozen yogurt for your family do not seem like the actions of someone who is planning to kill themselves in the near future. However, as the years have gone on, I've become a lot more attuned to the fact that suicidal people don't always give off any visible signs that there was anything wrong with them and keep everything bottled up inside so that it winds up coming as a complete shock to their loved ones when they decide to take their own life. While I'm not necessarily saying this is what happened with Mike O'Mara, the big issue is that if you try to piece together a scenario which points towards foul play, none of them make much sense either. So here are how all the events unfolded. Mike has an ordinary dinner at home with his family before he tells them he has to go out and run some errands. He stops by the office for his security business, Private Security Institute, to apparently drop some work off, but unfortunately, none of the sources provide any specific details about this. If he was planning suicide, there has to be a reason why he elected to stop there before he went off to kill himself, so I would be interested to know if he did anything which might have foreshadowed that. He then gets on his car radio and informs dispatch that he's currently on duty, and it's around 45 minutes later when he's discovered dead at the service area. Of course, the other detail which seems to go against the suicide theory is that he would go to the trouble of placing the nozzle from the gas pump into his fuel tank before he decided to walk out onto the lawn and shoot himself. But on the other hand, if someone wanted to murder Mike, doing so at a public location where police officers are known to stop by and gas up their vehicles does not seem like the most logical spot to do it. I mean, Mike was ultimately discovered by a patrolman who pulled into the service area to get gas a short time after Mike was killed, so there would have been a risk of being caught in the act. There was no sign of a struggle or any evidence that an outside party had been there, and while witnesses reported hearing a gunshot, no one actually saw anything. The prevalent homicide theory is that this was an ambush, and Mike was somehow lured away from his car onto the lawn before he was killed. But unless the responsible party had been watching Mike's house and following him since he left, how could they have known he would be at this service area at that particular time? Again, if Mike was working on some sort of a big case, I could see someone watching him, but why go to this trouble to murder a guy working a quiet desk job? A third possibility which has been pushed forward is that Mike's death could have been an accident where, for unknown reasons, he decided to grab his gun and flashlight and walk out onto the lawn before he somehow tripped, causing the gun to discharge a bullet into his forehead before his body fell forward onto the boulder. However, when you look at the logistics of the whole thing, I do think that scenario is very unlikely, and there's probably million-to-one odds that such a freak accident would occur to leave Mike in that position. Now, one of the reasons Barbara O'Mara instantly became suspicious was because when the police arrived at her residence a few hours later, they immediately informed her that Mike's death was a suicide. They would later deny that they ever said this, but if true, it does seem pretty irresponsible to say this before an official investigation could be performed. I can see why Barbara would have gotten the impression that they were closing the investigation as quickly as possible because some sort of cover-up was taking place. But here's a detail which does stick out as suspicious. There's a website called ipsn.org, which is run by a former Cook County police officer and contains a number of articles and documents about police corruption and organized crime in Illinois. It contains an article about the O'Mara case, which says that when the police showed up at Barbara's door to inform her about Mike's death, they asked for his service revolver, and she grabbed it from the bedroom and gave it to him. Well, this is the only source I've ever seen which mentions that detail, but it's very confusing to me. Does this mean that Mike had more than one service revolver? The official cover story is that Mike kept it inside his briefcase, and it was lying next to his body when he was found, so I don't see how the police could be retrieving it from his bedroom hours later. Is this supposed to imply that the guns were switched around in order to make Mike's death look like a suicide? Ordinarily, I wouldn't read much into this, but they never did recover the fatal bullet which killed Mike, so it was never proven with 100% certainty that it originated from his revolver. Regardless of whether you believe this was homicide or suicide, I think you'll agree that not recovering the bullet was the biggest mistake in the investigation. Under normal circumstances, it should be pretty easy to determine if someone was able to use their own gun to shoot themselves, but that was not the case here, as even though traces of gunshot residue were found on Mike's hands, they were so minute that they could have gotten there without him firing a weapon. It really does seem that the Cook County Sheriff's Police Department were content to write off Mike's death as a suicide, but was this because they were complicit, or could it have been due to massive indifference? Well, there is a case to be made for the latter explanation. At the time, the Cook County Sheriff's Police Chief was James Walsh, who did not get along well with Mike O'Mara. Throughout the years, Walsh and O'Mara were known for having some major differences of opinion, and this might explain why O'Mara was assigned to a quiet job in the Records Division. Walsh's animosity seemed to stem from an incident in 1973 when O'Mara was assigned to be part of an investigation into alleged misconduct involving Walsh and a theft ring. While nothing ever came of the investigation, and Walsh was never charged with anything, it was believed that Walsh always held a massive grudge against O'Mara over the whole thing. Following O'Mara's death, Lieutenant Jack Reed, who had a reputation for being one of the most skilled investigators on the Cook County Sheriff's Police, was assigned to the case before Walsh abruptly removed him. Reed suspected that he was taken off the case because he did not completely endorse the suicide ruling, stating, quote, "There was a rush to judgment. They made up their minds it was suicide, and they were going to go with that," end quote. Now, here's an interesting thread which ties this story to the Ralph Probst case. You'll probably recall me mentioning a disgraced former Cook County Sheriff's Lieutenant named James Keating, who was the first policeman to arrive at the Probst murder scene. Keating would eventually become Michael O'Mara's right-hand man when he headed his own vice unit, and since the two men were always on friendly terms, O'Mara was reportedly left in shock when Keating was exposed as being massively corrupt. When Keating spent years stonewalling the investigation into the murder of Diane Masters, it was Lieutenant Jack Reed who finally broke the case wide open and ensured that Keating and his co-conspirators were indicted for their roles in the crime. In 1992, they actually released a made-for-TV movie about the Masters case titled Deadly Matrimony, and Reed was portrayed by the late great actor Brian Dennehy. In fact, Dennehy was such an admirer of Reed that he personally directed and starred in a number of other made-for-TV movies based on cases Reed worked on during his police career. So long story short, if Michael O'Mara's death was a homicide, it sounds like Jack Reed was the one investigator you would have wanted working the case, but that opportunity was taken away from him. In addition, the medical examiner, Dr. Robert Stein, later testified that he also wanted to perform a more thorough investigation into O'Mara's death, but was pressured by the higher-ups to classify it as suicide. Again, this may have been done because the police wanted to cover something up, or it could have simply been because Chief Walsh personally disliked O'Mara. Of course, the financial motive for doing this is that the department would not have to pay out Mike's pension and benefits to his family if his death was a suicide, which is a pretty cold-hearted way of handling things, but also provides a potential explanation for their actions that does not involve a murder conspiracy. While there was no evidence that an outside party besides Mike was at the service area on the night he was killed, the one detail which might point towards foul play is that he appeared to have some abrasions on his face in the crime scene photos. I have not personally seen the photos, but some of the people who did thought it looked like he had received a beating, a conclusion which might be supported by a hematoma on his skull. As far as motive for the crime, the only person who has ever been pushed forward as a potential suspect was a former sheriff's officer who had been suspended for alcohol-related issues 1 month before Amara's death, and reportedly vowed to get revenge. Since there aren't many details available about this person, it's unclear how much of a role O'Meara actually played in getting him suspended, but I do think the police made a huge mistake by not at least interviewing the guy, and since he died 6 months later, it's very difficult to surmise his potential involvement. But even if he had enough hatred against Mike to commit murder, how could he have known that Mike would be at the service area at that particular time? The biggest evidence against suicide was the analysis from Dr. Vincent DiMaio, who found it unlikely that Mike would have held the gun a couple inches from his head when he shot himself. Well, by the time the Unsolved Mysteries episode was released in 1995, James Walsh had been replaced as Cook County Sheriff's Police Chief by a guy named William Burke, who pushed forward a unique theory during his interview. On the surface, the circumstances of O'Meara's death do not resemble a suicide, but what if he intentionally planned it that way? Here's what Chief Burke said during his interview. Quote, "He may have chosen to have it not be a contact wound because he taught homicide investigation. I mean, he taught courses and he taught about suicides. So he knows if he wanted to make it look like something other than it was, he may have deliberately done that." End quote. While that idea might seem pretty absurd, a police officer going out of their way to make their suicide look like a homicide is not unprecedented. The most famous example of this might be the story of Joe Glinowitz, who worked as a lieutenant for the Fox Lake Police Department in Illinois before he was found shot to death in September of 2015. Shortly before he was killed, Glinowitz had made a radio call to dispatch where he said he was pursuing three suspects and there was a massive manhunt for these supposed cop killers until it became apparent they did not actually exist. It turned out that Glinowitz had fatally shot himself and staged the whole thing to make his suicide look like murder. An investigation revealed that Glinowitz had spent years performing criminal acts such as embezzling money, and since he knew his days were likely numbered, he decided to end his life in a manner which would make it look like he went out as a hero after being killed in the line of duty. Now, obviously, if you look at the lives and police careers of Joe Glinowitz and Michael O'Meara, there's a night and day difference, as Glinowitz was a very corrupt individual with quite a troubled background, whereas there's nothing to indicate that O'Meara had any skeletons in his closet. But let's just say that O'Meara was feeling suicidal. Would he have gone to the trouble of staging his death to make it look like he was the victim of foul play? Well, on the surface, there doesn't seem to be any obvious reasons for Mike to have taken his own life. Yes, he could have become depressed that he had been assigned to an unexciting desk job to close out his police career, but he had been making post-retirement plans for himself and his family. While Mike's private security business wasn't doing well and was probably going to fold, his wife confirmed that it was not causing the family to experience huge debts or any serious financial concerns. However, if you look at Mike's obituary in the June 5th, 1988 edition of the Southtown Star, it goes over his police career, but makes mention of the fact that Mike was among county officials who had been under fire because he was head of a special disaster unit, which did not have a comprehensive plan to cope with disasters. Indeed, if you search newspapers.com, you'll find a few articles from 1986 that mention this disaster unit, which was originally put together by the former Cook County Sheriff, who appointed Mike O'Meara to be the county's emergency services and disaster coordinator. Unfortunately, shortly after the unit was formed, heavy rainfall caused the Plains River to overflow, and after the area was hit with the worst flooding they'd experienced in over 25 years, O'Meara was one of the people hit with heavy criticism because the disaster unit was not prepared for it. While Mike's death did not take place until a year and a half after this incident, could it have bothered him enough to become suicidally depressed? I mean, it's not like this was some catastrophic disaster which caused the lives of many people, but who knows? The thing with suicidal people is that they can be very unpredictable and end their lives for reasons no one else could understand. Being from a devout Roman Catholic family, if Mike felt compelled to take his own life, he would have wanted to avoid the stigma of suicide, but there was also a financial incentive as well. I'm sure Mike was well aware that his pension and insurance would not pay out to his family in the event of a suicide, but there was a double indemnity clause if he was killed on the job. So Mike came up with a plan where he went through the motions of making his family believe this was nothing more than an ordinary, routine evening. When he left his residence, he made a point of asking them what type of frozen yogurt they wanted so they wouldn't have any reason to believe he wasn't coming back. The last reported communication from Mike was when he radioed into dispatch shortly after stopping by the office for his security business. Even though Mike was only planning to run some routine errands, he was technically still on duty because he was driving a department-assigned squad car, so it was standard procedure for him to radio in his whereabouts. However, that one final radio call might have been a calculated move on Mike's part, because if he wound up dead shortly thereafter, that would technically mean he was killed on the job, and the double indemnity clause would not pay out. So Mike then drove to the service area and started filling up his tank, because no one would suspect a suicidal person of doing that. He then grabbed his gun and flashlight before he walked out onto the lawn and shot himself to create the false impression that he was ambushed. While the O'Meara family were initially denied his insurance and death benefits, there were enough ambiguities with how Mike died that they did eventually get paid what they were owed after taking the matter to court. If this was Mike's plan all along, then it ultimately worked out in the long run. Look, I'm not saying that I'm 100% convinced that Mike's death was a suicide, and in most other cases like this, I probably wouldn't even acknowledge this possibility. If Mike really wanted to make himself look like the victim of foul play, then his best strategy would have been to send in a fake radio call to dispatch about pursuing suspects, which is what Joe Glinowitz did. But once again, the other issue is that if Mike's death was a murder, then it was pretty much the perfect crime. Other than the possible presence of lacerations on his face, there was no real evidence of foul play, and if there was an outside party involved, they got incredibly lucky that no other witnesses were in the area at the time, and they somehow managed to grab Mike's own gun away from him and shoot him in such a way that it fooled the authorities into believing it was a suicide. But while there wasn't much hard evidence to point to a homicide, I guess the biggest issue is that there wasn't exactly overwhelming evidence to point towards a suicide either, and it seems like certain people came to that conclusion without looking at all the facts. So even if there was no foul play involved, this case definitely merited a much more thorough investigation. Since the word suicide was removed from Mike's death certificate, I guess this one is officially classified as undetermined, but I don't think anyone has really looked into this case in a long time, and we may never know the full truth about what happened. However, if you happen to have any information about the death of Michael O'Meara, please contact the appropriate authorities. Anyway, another special thanks to Claire Simpson for narrating the opening of our episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't done so yet, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see covered on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about the controversial 1992 death of Michelle Witherall, who supposedly fell from the third-story balcony of her apartment until her husband was accused of murdering her. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to take a moment to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Amanda P., Peggy M., Alita S., Kimberly, and Lady K. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I just want to announce that I'm going to be appearing as a guest on an episode of a podcast called Riddle Me That to discuss the unsolved murder of an infant named Jacob Landine. Jacob's older brother Eric also hosts his own true crime podcast called True Consequences, and I'd like to play a promo for that show right now.
Hey everybody, this is Eric Carter Landine, the host and producer of True Consequences podcast. True Consequences is a true crime and mystery podcast with stories based in New Mexico and the American Desert Southwest. I started this show to bring light to cases that need to be solved in my state. You see, my brother was murdered 33 years ago, and his murderer still walks free. So I cover cases with an empathetic lens, because I understand what it's like to seek justice for a family member. I hope you'll give True Consequences a chance. You can find me wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'd also like to announce that later this year, provided that it becomes safe to travel again, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at two separate Crime Con events. The regular Crime Con, which takes place at the Fairmont Hotel in Austin, Texas, from June 4th until the 6th, and the very first Crime Con UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London the following weekend, on June 12th and the 13th. If you would like to purchase tickets to either event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount, and it applies to both the Austin and London events. So to receive 10% off, either visit crimecon.com or crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLD21. That's COLD21. In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I also just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.